One of the founding fathers that doesn't get the attention he deserves is Sam Adams, who's often been called the lightning rod of the American Revolution. Many people today know his name only because of Sam Adams beer, but according to some, the image on the beer is not even his mug, so to speak. In any event, the real Sam Adams is worth learning about. A classic book on the Christian roots of America was first released in 1987 by law professor John Eidsmo. It's entitled Christianity and the Constitution. But today, we're often told that the founders intended a godless constitution, so-called. And John Eidsmo does not agree with that viewpoint. One of the chapters in that book is on Sam Adams. This is Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and we welcome John Eidsmo back to the program. John, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Always a pleasure to talk with you, Jerry, and I appreciate the way you get the word out and also your own scholarship and George Washington's Sacred Fire, which I will have to say is the best book ever written on the religious faith of George Washington. And also the book you co-authored on Thomas Jefferson. I believe that was called Doubting Thomas.
Yes.
I wish I'd thought of that title.
Well, hey, I could listen to you all day. No, I'm just kidding. Okay, the feeling's mutual. All right, so let's go ahead and talk about Sam Adams. First of all, why should every American really know about who this guy was?
Well, Sam Adams is sometimes called the father of the American Revolution. And we hear talk today about something called the Black-Robed Regiment, that is, preachers who wear black robes but who battle for the American Constitutional Republic today, just like the Black-Robed Regiment of Sam Adams' time did so. Particularly the black-robed New England clergy, Sam Adams would sound the word in Boston, and it would be echoed in Puritan pulpits all throughout New England. When he would talk about independence, they too would talk about independence, but what a lot of people don't realize is that Sam Adams was coming from very much a distinctively Christian standpoint.
Okay, do you care to elaborate on that? That's the Christian standpoint.
I'd be glad to.
Sure.
I'd be glad to. Sam Adams, he's one of the older of the founding fathers, and he was not a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, but he was very prominent in the war for independence. And Sam Adams had either been saved or rededicated his life to Christ during the Great Awakening, the religious revival of 1740. It seemed like Americans had, to some extent, maybe fallen away a little bit from their religious fervor of the 1600s, the Puritans, and so on in those days. But that slide away was arrested by this great revival with preachers like Jonathan Edwards, George Whitefield, and others. And as Sam Adams' biographer, John Miller, describes Sam Adams, explains who he was and what his thinking was, he talks about how that revival influenced Sam Adams' entire life. He says, Sam Adams never forgot those stirring days during the Great Awakening when George Whitefield thundered in the pulpit and New Englanders seemed to turn the clock back to the time of Winthrop and Cotton. The glimpse Adams caught of Puritanism in 1740 had profound influence upon his later career. It became one of his strongest desires to restore Puritan manners and morals to New England. In his eyes, the chief purpose of the American Revolution was to separate New England from the decadent mother country in order that Puritanism might again flourish as it had in the early 1600s. Sam Adams hoped to do by means of a political revolution what George Whitefield had done through a religious awakening. Puritanism was his goal, revolution his method of attaining it.
That is fascinating. In fact, I think George Bancroft, the great historian from the 19th century, said that Sam Adams was the last of the Puritans or something like that. There was a phrase along those lines.
That phrase has been used quite a number of times about Sam Adams, the last of the Puritans. And in fact, John Miller observes that he's buried in the old churchyard there at Boston. And he says Sam Adams was at last among the Puritans.
Oh, but interesting.
In the Declaration of Independence, when the Declaration of Independence was issued and signed, Sam Adams declared that we have restored the sovereign to his throne. He reigns in heaven, and from the dawn till the setting of the sun, may his kingdom come. And he never departed from that form of thinking. In fact, in
the he, by the way, the he there in that quote is talking about God. It's talking about really Jesus, isn't it?
Talking about Jesus Christ, absolutely. Jesus Christ. In fact, you look to what he said in 1797. He served one last term as governor of Massachusetts at that time, and that's an important position. The governor of Massachusetts, because of the Constitution of Massachusetts, he had probably more power than any other figure in the United States except the president. But he served one last term in the 1790s, and on March 20th, 1797, he issued a fasting proclamation, and I might add, this is 6 years after the Bill of Rights and the First Amendment was adopted, but he says in that fasting proclamation, "We cannot better express ourselves than by humbly supplicating the supreme ruler of the world that the rod of tyrants may be broken into pieces and the oppressed made free, that wars may cease in all the earth, and that the confusions that are and have been among the nations may be overruled by promoting and speedily bringing on that holy and happy period when the kingdom of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ may be everywhere established, and all people everywhere willingly bow to the scepter of him who is Prince of Peace." That was Adams' conviction way, way back in the 1740s and continued throughout his life.
That's a fascinating thing. That is an official proclamation of him as the governor of Massachusetts, and that is hard to square with today's modern views of so-called separation of church and state.
Well, it would certainly suggest to us that Sam Adams and people of his day had a better understanding of what the First Amendment actually meant than some of our radical separationist lawyers and judges do today. Again, this is 6 years after the adoption of the First Amendment.
Okay, Sam Adams was involved with a group called, maybe even helped form it, the Sons of Liberty. Can you tell us about them and also about the committees of correspondence? What does that mean, and how did they work, and what was Sam's role in all that? Sons of Liberty, committees of correspondence. I'm going to sit down and just listen to you lecture. I love listening to you, John Eisenbaum. Great law professor. Go ahead. Sons of Liberty, committees of correspondence.
Sam Adams and his father, who is kind of known as Deacon Adams because of his church background, but they would hold regular meetings, and these were called song fests, actually, but it was said that they produced more revolutionaries than songbirds, but they did both because they saw them as trying to accomplish the very same thing, to achieve this independence that would enable America to truly be the Christian nation that they wanted America to be. And when I say America is a Christian nation, I think we need to understand what we mean by that. First of all, we don't mean that Christianity is the official religion of the United States. It is not, and never was, at least since the Constitution was adopted, and I don't think should be. Nor do we mean by this that only Christians are citizens or that unbelievers are second-class citizens. What we mean by this is America is a nation that is founded upon values, values that are found in the Bible, and values that were brought over to this country primarily by strong professing Christians. It means that the Constitution itself is adopted by people who were for the most part Christians. The overwhelming majority of those delegates to the convention were Christian men. Of the 55 delegates, some 28 were members of the Church of England, an Orthodox church in those days. 7 were Congregationalists, and 6 were Presbyterians, and there were several others who were Lutheran and Catholic and Methodist and Reformed. That leaves maybe 3 or 4, 6 to 8% who were not. So it came out of a Christian foundation. But anyway, specifically, the Sons of Liberty were a group of people somewhat like the Black Regiment that I met earlier, but this was not limited to clergy. These were people who were prepared to stand up for American liberty and actually take up arms if necessary. And the Committee of Correspondence, well, it was recognized that in those days, among these 13 colonies, sometimes communications were not the best. And in fact, communications, let's say, between New Hampshire and Georgia commonly would go through England first. And in fact, the colonies, in some cases, were not even allowed to trade with one another. They had to send their trade to England. And then England, let's say, if you're from Massachusetts, you sell your goods to an English merchant, and then he might sell them to somebody in South Carolina, and so on. So communications were not the best. You didn't have internet, you didn't have Fox News, you didn't have any of these things, and unfortunately, you also didn't have Jerry Newcomb to communicate the word. And so the committees and correspondents were designed in the various colonies to keep each other informed of what's going on. If Patrick Henry is giving a speech there in Virginia about give me liberty and give me death, people up in Massachusetts need to know about it. And likewise, Patrick Henry and others in Virginia need to know what's going on up in the New England colonies. And anyway, the committees of correspondence were just designed to keep everybody up to date on what was going on, because you might say they were the internet of the American Revolution. I just thought of that term right now, but that may be the best way to describe them. The internet of the American Revolution.
Okay, wow. Now, just so we understand, as far as the Sons of Liberty, there's no official designation that somebody would, you know, join something and become that. It was more of just a like a loose ad hoc term for people who were just involved, and they were so concerned about their rights as Englishmen, as Christians, when those rights were being trampled upon by Great Britain.
I don't have that much information as to the actual organization of the Sons of Liberty, but my guess is that would be correct, and it'd be correct for a reason, and that's that they wouldn't want the British to be able to break in somewhere and find a membership list of the Sons of Liberty so they could go out and perform arrests. In fact, I think that's a practice that is followed sometimes by dissident organizations today to keep their organizations localized and loosely based so that sometimes we use that word plausible deniability so that there is no central register that the government can turn to find out who they are.
Sure. Okay, we have about 2 minutes left. I'd like you to talk a little bit about the Boston Tea Party and the moves of resistance and the, let's say, the Christian justification for things like that, especially if there's some property broken or anybody, heaven forbid, hurt.
The Boston Tea Party was an objection to taxation, not so much the amount of the taxation as to the fact that the taxation itself was illegitimate. It had no constitutional authority from Parliament or from the King, either one. And it's interesting that those who conducted the Boston Tea Party, they were respectable citizens. These are not a bunch of revolutionaries. And they were very careful to avoid destroying any property. And they insisted to the sea captains and so on that we have nothing against you. We have nothing against your tea or anything like that. We just object to the tax on legal grounds. And in fact, they insisted on paying for the tea. They said, our gripe is not against you and the tea, it's against the tax. Not only that, but in order to get at that tea, on one occasion, they had to break into a chest. In order to do that, they had to break open a lock, and they actually replaced the lock that they had to break into. These were not lawless revolutionaries. They were engaged in a legitimate interposition. In fact, this, I would say, the American Revolution, in a sense, is not even properly named. It should be called the American War for Independence, because they were seeking to separate themselves from another country that I believe they had every legal and moral and constitutional right to separate themselves from.
So this is that old Calvinist thing about the, I forget what you call it, the lesser magistrate?
Yeah. Some call it the doctrine of the lesser magistrate.
Right, okay, yeah.
Some call it the interposition, but it's certainly not limited to Calvinists, in fact.
Sure. We're basically talking
about interposition long before Calvin. So did Thomas Aquinas before him.
Right, and we're basically out of time. By the way, you know who's good on that too is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in his letter to the Birmingham address, that Birmingham letter. But we are out of time. Morallaw.org. John Eidsmo, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us. All the best.
You too, Jerry.